Up next, our podcast-only edition of Dig Deep, where we keep talking about that caller we had during our live segment during the Monday morning show. I'm Heidi Holt, and I'm News and Public Affairs Director at KEXE KBXE. We're proud to bring you this conversation between Aaron Brown, you know him from Minnesota Brown, he's our liberal commentator, and Chuck Marone, you know him from Strong Towns, he's our conservative commentator. Okay.
What are we doing here?
Yeah, I know.
I guess it's podcast only, so we can do
that's
whatever.
Right.
Right.
It's the Dig Deep podcast only edition for the month of June.
Can we continue on this multiplier thing for a second?
Yeah. So that was we had a caller who called in about wanted to know what you guys thought of copper nickel mining.
Yeah.
Thanks again to Gord from Aiken. And you guys talked about it, and then Gord offered midway through about this idea of it's not just the copper nickel mining jobs. It's a multiplier for jobs.
Right.
Let me say this, because I hear this a lot. And like right now in Brainerd, we're dealing with, transportation projects and investments for parking. And we're building a new water tower on the south side of town. And I hear this rhetoric over and over and over again. You know, it's all about jobs. You got to invest to, create growth. If you're not spending money, if you're not in the game, nothing's going to happen. This is all like the rhetoric imposed on us. When I talk about how frustrated I am that I put on my Twitter feed and I get Trump, when I'm not following Trump, what I'm getting is like the shared memes. But it's not just Trump. It's like the shared narrative. Nationally, it's the centralized narrative. And from an economic standpoint, when I hear, well, there's a multiplier for every job that's created at the mine, there's three more jobs created in the community. That is BS. That is not true. That is not true. There may be three jobs created in the macro economy. One of those jobs might be a pencil pusher in, DC, and another one might be a Wall Street analyst who's looking at the company doing it. But it is total BS to say that all of a sudden we get this money being passed around this community and there's this huge multiplier effect where every job we create is three jobs. And even to the extent that it is true, it's like throwing gas on a fire. And then once the gas burns out, all that is gone. All that is gone. The way that small towns and rural areas like ours take something like a copper nickel mine and turn it into wealth and prosperity is to actually use it to build up our local capacity. We use it to build a sewer and water pipe out to the edge of Hibbing so they can have a McDonald's drive-through. It's like, let's use our money to create a noose and a gun so we can hang ourselves and shoot ourselves at the same time. I am for copper nickel mining, and I think that, and I'll say it, I think the environmental loonies down in the Twin Cities who are like, anytime they'll use their copper nickel mined cell phone to call their legislator and bitch about, what's happening. I find them to be annoying because I don't feel like, I feel like they're more motivated than they are informed.
You know what bugs me about that, what you just said, is that people do assume that you called them environmental loonies.
I did.
That it's Twin Cities people and that everybody who lives here is for more jobs or for this copper nickel mining and is willing to contaminate their water to have jobs for the next, 200 jobs for the next 10 years or something.
But no one's willing to contaminate their water. That's the point.
I don't think it is. That's sort of the national narrative, that it's people in the Twin Cities who are against it, and it's people who live here who are for it. And I don't think that's completely right.
I agree with you. I just think that people here largely have more local nuance to it than... when you listen to the Democratic primary for governor and you hear the questions that they're being asked, the stuff on copper nickel mining coming out of the Twin Cities, there's no care about jobs at all, like zero. There's no care about the local economy at all. It's zero. It's all an environmental resource for us to use for recreational purposes. It's not even about people, you know, having their water contaminated in the sense that like the bubbas up on the range are going to have to drink, you know, contaminated water. It's all about like the, you know, how can we preserve this for our use? And that's where I, when I talk about environmental loonies, I'm talking about people who like don't, no one up here wants to drink contaminated water. Like I don't hear anyone saying, I'm willing to have some contamination in my drinking well, you know, it's just so we can have a few jobs. I do hear people saying like, I want to streamline this process and I don't care what, you know, I'm less concerned about that. I'm more willing to trust companies. And by the way, I'm willing to give them tens of millions or hundreds of millions of dollars of subsidies because it's going to create 500 jobs and that will have a multiplier effect. I think that's loony too.
Aaron, your thoughts?
I have many. When we talk about the boundary waters, for instance, which seems to be one of the linchpins of the debate, you're actually locally reopening an old wound with the creation of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area, which was a major debate back in the 70s, which we can now, you know, say like our oldest listeners remember it vividly, you know, because that was the one of the major political debates of that time locally. It kind of got dormant and quiet with the existence of the BWCA, and we get used to it. It becomes kind of a, in stasis, you know. And this mining issue now reopens the wound in a different way. You know, this thing that exists now, this federal protected wilderness, and the notion of there being such a thing as a federally protected wilderness, a place where you can go and where the where there won't be any development on purpose, is now, you know, put in juxtaposition with this potential mining in the Ely area and the Hoyt Lakes area. Well, it opens up a lot of those same wounds. So there's a lot of that that goes into this, which creates the notion of, well, you know, those locals would just mine it and destroy it if they could, you know, and the locals saying, well, they don't understand our jobs and all this. It seems to be where the debate has gone, and it's been there for 15 years. 20 years. So there's that part of this. Now, the other thing that I have learned, you know, as I've tried to cover and understand this issue, is if you are affiliated with, say, let's say a taconite mine in northern Minnesota, an iron mine, and you work there, yeah, and what Chuck just said is exactly what you would hear, which is, I don't want to drink poisoned water. I know environmental people, engineers and environmental scientists who work for mines, and it's their job to make sure that we don't drink poisoned water, and they take it very seriously. And it's not something that is just like, oh, whatever. It's Homer Simpson at the nuclear power plant. You know, it doesn't really matter. You know, we accidentally spilled a bunch of poison into the water today. It was, no, it's not like that. They're very serious and very good at their jobs. And so if your frame of reference is that, is you know, trying to maintain this beautiful area, people go fishing and hunting. If they work at the mines, they care about the nature. They live in the nature. I live, you know, 27 miles from town, and my neighbor is a miner. You know, he works at a mine, and he commutes in. And so that's not an oxymoron the way I think a lot of people from outside the area might think it is, that you would support a clean environment and mining. So that's one thing I've learned. Another thing I've learned is that not all opposition to the mining, like Heidi, like you were mentioning, comes from outside the area. And one of the most obvious examples that I think is also very cultural, which means it's not as easy as, like, you know, allocating a resource. It's a cultural argument. If your people came to northern Minnesota, you know, 500 to 5,000 years ago, and the reason they came was because of a vision of there being food that grows on the water, and that food was discovered and it was wild rice, and you've lived off of it for a long time, and the argument is, well, why do we need to worry so much about wild rice? You know, we need the jobs. There's kind of a disconnect there as well. What's in it for a person whose sole focus is the water and to the, you know, in, by connection, the wild rice, what incentive is there for a person like that to accept the argument that, don't worry, we got this. We got this environmental stuff. Don't worry about it. You know, these people over here need jobs. You don't need to worry. I find that if you're coming from that point of view, like, what do you mean, don't worry? You know, that doesn't make any sense if that's your point of view. So I've learned that it's a little more dug in, you know, for this reason. This is one of the reasons it's immovable. There's a lot of misinformed opinions on the whole thing. Mm-hmm. A lot of people come into this with, this mining is no problem. You know, in fact, it is different than taconite mining. It does involve different processes and the composition of what you're mining is different. It can be engineered such that you can mitigate the risks of that mining, that technology exists, but it costs money. So what we're really talking about is, do we really expect the mining company that comes in to spend the money? This is the question I would rather talk about, because if the mining companies are held to a certain standard, you know, the engineering is there. And if the issue is cultural on the other side and the danger to water, you know, you have to do a lot more than just make a promise, because promises have been broken many times before by mining companies. And so you know, this is the world we live in, where we have to talk about the real things. The debate, it's there's something kind of poetic, maybe poetic is the wrong word, about us having a live Dig Deep call-in show that lasts 50 minutes on live radio, and we pontificate, Chuck and I, back and forth for most of it, and we get one call, and it's about copper nickel mining, because I just feel like, man, this region will look back at this period in time. A historian will look back and say, how foolish. What a waste of our time to spend this much energy on this poor of an understanding of an issue. And we might or might not get something. We might or might not be good. But in the end, it'll be like, what, you guys did this? You know, you didn't realize that the world was losing fresh water, and that your water and the control of it was actually the most important thing. I view that as likely as polymet happening and it working out really, really well. You know, this is the thing that I don't quite understand, why we are unable to put aside your biases and beliefs. That's the part of the issue. But why we can't focus on a larger picture together. And it's because nobody wants to, you know, like Chuck said, if you're against it, you don't want to concede that it could ever happen. If you're for it, you don't want to concede that it ever might not happen. And that's where we're at.
Let me walk through something, because I think actually Aaron and I probably agree on this. And I think our agreement probably represents a broad swath of public consensus. Here's the first point I'd like to see if we agree on. When Europeans first came to the United States, first came to North America, they walked across this continent and they came across copper nuggets laying on the ground, like the size of automobiles, solid, you know, pure, just like easy picking copper. And if you look at like the early days of copper use in this country, we were prolific with it because it was very easy to get. When you look at it today, there's a massive amount of effort that goes in to get like point something percent pure copper. Like you get one big truck out of out of the ground of copper, and it has like a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction.
And that's the kind of mining these projects are talking about, is enormous amounts of overburden that's refined down to a product.
So this is where I want to put this out and see if we agree on this. The longer we wait to mine this, the more valuable it will be when it's mined. In other words, there's not like an urgent, it's not like a blueberry plant. I think your analogy was really good, where like if we don't do it now, it wilts. It's actually like a wealth resource in the ground that if you think about, like, we've buried gold in the ground, and the gold, you know, is becomes more scarce every day because it's used in other places and people want it. The longer it sits there, the more valuable it becomes. Is that a fair?
I agree with that. And in fact, the whole thing about, I've gotten to research and know more about mining as a journalism major. You just, it pours in and I have to learn it. But the thing about mining is that the value is what it's all about. The value is the reason you outlay money to go. The Merritt brothers took their limited logging, you know, financing that they had got from being timber cruisers and things like that, and they spent money bringing a few experts into the forests of northern Minnesota at expense, and they might not find anything, and they would lose all that money. They do it because of the suspicion that there's valuable mineral there, and then they dig and they work and they find it, and it's all a story of at what point does this stuff become so valuable that it's worth spending money on better shovels, spending money on a railroad, which is what they ultimately had to do. And that's what all of this is. And we live in a modern world where all that stuff is kind of taken for granted, but that's still what it is. Is it worth putting all these big trucks, these million-dollar trucks and these billion-dollar plants, is it worth it to do all that for what's there? And
when we look at the exponential demand of copper, the demand for copper is growing exponentially, mm-hmm. and the amount of it is tanking, and it takes this huge amount of overburden.
The price is low now, and it will be for a little while because of the global market, but yes, in time it will go up, and as will virtually everything, whether it's iron, water, well, maybe not iron, because iron actually you can get from a lot of different sources, which is one of the issues long term, but anything precious is gonna go up in price, why are we in a hurry? And what I don't understand, and this is what I keep saying, and I don't, people blink, they just blink when you say this, but if we are operating under the assumption that the mineral resource is the people's, whether it's the state or the broad concept of the society owns the mineral, the company puts out the risk so they reap the most profits, but the product belongs to the people. They license it essentially, and we should receive a royalty as people. The people should get something out of this. If that's what we believe, and it seems to be what we believe according to the debate, you know, then why are we negotiating like groupies?
This is my second. I have four things I think we agree on.
Yeah.
The second one is because this is a precious resource. And because it is only increasing in value, as we go out in time, it's only going to become more scarce, more valuable, more used, unless there's a copper substitute at some point. Mm-hmm. But like, really, it is a valuable mineral. There's always going to be demand for it. Why would we ever subsidize a company? Why would the economics of this ever require the large-scale subsidy of a company to do it? Why, if it needed subsidy, wouldn't we just wait until the price went up and could justify it?
Mm-hmm. So that they would put the money out, and that's what mining has always done, you know. But that changed, you know, that changed in the '60s with the growth of the taconite industry and the economic fear of losing the employment.
Well, that's the other part. So mm-hmm. so we're the reason we would subsidize is because we want the jobs,
right?
And I guess what I'm saying is, if we're going to spend millions subsidizing this to pull this resource out of the ground, I would, if it's about jobs, I would give that money to people up here before I would spend it doing.
IRRB, instead of outlaying $10 million in a high risk loan or what will ultimately be forgiven as a grant, instead of doing that for some private company that is, you know, not proven, one of the proven things you could do is just give the money. If you want to help your people, give the money to the people in some form of credit or in some sort of, you know, educational credit, a tax relief, or whatever you want to call it ideologically, but put the money in the community so that people spend it in the community. You know,
there's like a gazillion, I mean, there's yeah. like an infinite number of ways to spend that money better. That would have that would create more jobs and have a better. Why we feel culturally it's okay to launder money through an international mining company as opposed to just do something else with it?
Yeah,
I to me that's like a cultural defect we have.
Yeah, I agree.
So we've agreed on two things. One, it's in the ground and it's only becoming more valuable. And two, because of the economics of it, there's no need to subsidize someone to come in and take it out. We're better off just being patient. So the third thing I think we would agree on is that whoever ultimately does come in and take it out needs to be prepared to spend the money, put aside the a trust fund or
financial
a bond
assurance, they call it.
Financial assurance to ensure that there is no environmental damage done to this immediately in the midterm and in the long term. Those can be done through you know, different types of bonding, different types of setting money aside, different types of escrow accounts.
Yeah.
It can be done with independent third-party monitoring and aggressive reporting that's made public immediately. So there's ultimate transparency. I don't see why we can't do this in a way that would satisfy the environmental concerns of people.
Which
the concerns are legitimate. Yes. It's just like the idea that it can't be done is what I find loony or illegitimate.
And I think we're very close to agreement on this as well, the financial assurance picture. I will say that in the debate, it gets tricky trying to understand the limits of a financial assurance package.
The fox is guarding the hen house. Because the people who are writing the permit are also the people saying, we got to have this mine because of jobs and da-da-da-da-da. And so are they really like dotting every I and crossing every T and being like the hard asses on our behalf that they should be.
Right.
Sorry, I just said.
Well, it's allowed. Okay. Anyway, even if it was on the radio, you're good.
Okay, good.
Yeah,
we're not live right now. No. But exactly. And this is what drives me nuts about the debate is if you could just say, hey, mining companies, you're a business. You bring a proposal to us to mine. There are some concerns we have. And you know, we actually mean what we say when we want this to be environmentally conscious mining. We want you to take care of what you break, essentially. And there's a model for this in other places. There's a model right here in how we've regulated taconite. Now, I will say that
this is where I think going to Norway and looking at their model is actually like a good, there's some good models there.
There's other models out there. It's not impossible to imagine this taking place. I think, though, like what Chuck said is there's this kind of, you know, when the local governments and to some extent the state of Minnesota, even under DFL governors, has pretty much been the same way, which is we're really hesitant to actually call out a mining company on an environmental issue, especially when the mining company will it's like the old communication habits of a family, you know. And when Uncle so and so says this,
it's so uncomfortable.
Aunt so and so is going to respond with she's going to cry, and then cousin so and so is going to intervene, and all of these patterns kind of. The relationship with mining companies in the state is very much the same way. Going back 100 years, I'm reading some of these things from 104 years ago, and it is. I almost copied something and pasted it in Facebook without context just to see how many people thought I was talking about the mining companies now.
Right.
You know,
they're very sensitive. They're very defensive and they react as though any negative thing could be the thing that would kill them. But they also are very strong and powerful in their own way. And will take other actions to try to undermine, you know, the criticism in a different place. It's almost like a playbook. And there have been times in regional history where there have been strong local governments or state governments that might stand up to the mining companies. And ultimately, it's kind of like, you know, game respects game, and they end up working out a deal. Right now, we don't... If you say, hey, mining company, could you maybe reduce the sulfite level in this body of water just a little bit? You know, I was using some technology, and it's like, oh, we can't afford that technology. Mm-hmm. That's, are you nuts? We'll be dead in a week. And there's some, obviously, anything. The problem is mining is mining is a business that is it'd be hard not to be super sensitive over cost because
it's a commodity.
It's a commodity, and any little fluctuation in price or demand could ruin you, and in fact does ruin people all the time. So these companies are sensitive for a reason about these things. But there's also this, like, okay, they're gonna react that way when you start talking about paying more for environmental mitigation. They're gonna react that way. Question is, are you willing to stick to your argument that this needs to happen through those machinations and responses that you're gonna get? Right now, our local government is crass way to put it would be, they're bought and paid for, but they're not.
I think the way they're bought is they've bought into the cultural narrative.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. They don't.
The incorrect.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cultural narrative mm-hmm. about jobs and the multiplier effect and all
right,
that.
Right.
I feel like we interrupted you. You were going to.
Oh, I was just going to say last Friday, Marshall Helmberger was reporting on with us on U.S. Steel applying to the MPCA to lower the regulations on the Dark River.
Yeah.
And of their, how do you describe that? Of the sulfate levels.
Yeah, exactly.
And they were pretty sure that they would do that because there isn't the EPA at the federal level was not going to back
right.
anything up, and that's how it was going to go. And so it's always really confusing to me if I hear, because Marshall reports mm-hmm. on a lot of this stuff, but if the sulfate levels are too high, if they've crossed what the standards are, but then nothing happens to the yeah. company
so,
for doing that.
So this is the dirty little secret that is at the root of all of the sensitivity over particularly the sulfate standard
yeah.
and the wild, what they call the wild rice standard. So it's 10 parts per million parts of, or per gallon or whatever it's 10 tiny little molecules of this is considered to be the limit. And, we're arguing about whether PolyMet can hit that 10 parts. And of course, early on, PolyMet's argument was, yes, we can. With reverse osmosis, we can hit that. If that was the only argument, then there probably wouldn't be as much controversy. But underneath all of it is the fact that some of the pits out by the old LTV plant, out by MinTac, are full of water that's up around 1,000 plus parts per gallon or whatever of sulfate. Now, and then the flip side of this is the whole science argument, which is the sulfate itself is not harmful, which is why it's not poisoned water. It's the sulfate's potential to get out of the pit and react with carbon and create the sulfides that would be poisonous to the wild rice. That so 10 parts, and then you say, well, we need this to be 10 parts per million, which is the environmental position. And the other side is saying, the mining side is saying, well, that's way too low. You can't do that. Now, you can do that, but you'd have to then have all the taconite mines and everybody else who uses and water treatment plants and all these other places that have holding ponds of water to go back and realize that they're up at 250, 500, 1,000, 2,000. I mean, it's not unthinkable for all those numbers to be true. So that's what makes everybody nervous, is because reverse osmosis at PolyMet is one thing, but making the five or six existing mines retroactively treat the water. Now, there's technology coming out. I've written about it. That you don't have to use reverse osmosis. You can actually use bacteria to gobble up a lot of that sulfate, but it all costs money, and they don't want to spend it.
So I feel like we've agreed on three things.
Mm-hmm.
We've agreed that the resource is not going anywhere and it grows in value mm-hmm. longer it sits. We've agreed that there's no need to subsidize anybody to come in and take it out. And we've agreed that whoever ultimately does should have the full cost of independent environmental mitigation and verification mm-hmm. and monitoring.
Yep.
And that they should be held to like an incredibly high standard with no regulatory capture mm-hmm. involved.
Yeah.
I feel like the fourth thing then, this is my last one, is that to make this work for us, to make it more than just a transaction, we need to do the hard work between now and the time this comes out of the ground of creating economic ecosystems that actually do have a multiplier effect.
Mm-hmm.
A local multiplier effect, not a macro multiplier effect, but actually like a local multiplier effect. So that the money that is turned from this resource into cash actually goes to building our capacity, to making us in a post-mining world, or in a world when this resource is gone and we're doing something else, it's not a boom or bust. We're actually at some place where we're better off as a region, as a people, for the way we invested this money, the what we did with this money. We grew our capacity. We created local economic ecosystems. Here's the great thing. We don't have to wait for a mine to start doing those things. Those things will pay off now. They just pay off even more when we have mining. And so I feel like if we are not committed to that fourth thing, then why bother with the mine? Like, why bother with it? You're just throwing gasoline on a fire so you can enjoy the pop, but you're not going to get any long-term heat from it.
I mentioned I had talked to my friend in the live broadcast, but he's an engineer, now lives in Alaska, but he was an engineer that worked on mining projects before he left for Alaska. And he's like a fourth generation Iron Range family, you know, so they've just like mine, they've been around the whole time. And I was talking about economic diversification, making arguments kind of like what you just said. So to cut to the chase, yes, I think we have yet another agreement here. I was saying, yeah, well, it would be great if we could use the revenue, the resource to actually diversify the economy. And he goes, well, they're still mining, aren't they? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, you know, as long as they're mining, they aren't going to do any of that. And unfortunately,
you're saying as long as Saudi Arabia has oil,
right?
They'll just pump oil and they won't worry about
exactly. Other parts of their economy. And that is cynical, perhaps realistic though.
Sure.
And you know, I look at the region and I say, you know, well, you know, we're starting to see some new attitudes in like Crosby and Ironton on the Cuyuna Range, and they have different things going on down there that are not like the Mesabi Range, but one of the big ones is that they don't mine anymore, right. You know, and they haven't for enough time that, you know, nobody seriously thinks big mining operations are coming back. Now, Gord would disagree with me, I know, because there are some talk of manganese mines down by Emily or wherever and right. Things like that, but those are very small operations that they're talking about, and what's happened when you lose that all. Big poppy mining is coming back and going to take care of us again. When you lose that, you have to say, well, we have to do something ourselves. And so the community got together. They use recreation as one of their draws for the community. There's other things going on. They have the proximity to Brainerd, the proximity to the Twin Cities that also help them. But, you know, will the Mesabi Range communities see this before? You know, do they have to go all the way down with the taconite industry and where taconite shrinks down to one or two mines and maybe some scrap mining operations here or there when demand is high? Does it have to go all the way down before they'll wake up to this? And, you know, I hope not, but I concede that that might be true.
Right.
You know?
Right. I feel like that's the leadership part, right? Mm-hmm. That's the part where, like, as humans, we have to overcome our kind of cognitive biases to focus on the squirrel, mm-hmm. and think long term. And I think we have that capacity. I mean, that is actually where I feel like we've done the greatest disservice to our cities by our post-depression centralization, is that we've actually taken the idea of, you know, storing seeds in the ground and putting money aside and saving for a rainy day that like used to be part of our cult, our prudent, you know, hardy Scandinavian based culture. And we've stripped that out and we've said, pay your taxes and it's someone else's responsibility. And then we can just bitch about it, you know? And I would like to get back to a thing where we as intelligent, thoughtful people can stand back and recognize this transition problem, recognize that our own bias is to, you know, as long as the sun's shining, we don't have to worry about it. You know, as long as there's mining, we don't have to worry about diversifying our economy and let the better angels of our nature come forward and push that as a local agenda with having the capacity to actually do it. So I feel like we just solved the copper nickel mine problem.
We just did.
Yeah, four agreements there.
Unfortunately, I can imagine about 80% of the voting population finding some fault with it and therefore not wanting to do any of it.
Really? Because I feel like it's one of those...
Maybe that's not true.
I feel like it's one of those, like, you know, abortion, gun control issues where, like, the really loud extremes dominate the conversation and put all of us in this position where you can't apply any logic to it at mm-hmm. all. You have to pick like one of these two. And if you actually have nuanced conversations with people,
there's actually more agreement than you think. Yeah.
There's strong opinions, you know, they're rooted in strong opinions, but people grasp the nuance and mm-hmm. see that, you know, like, yeah, maybe women should have some sovereignty over their bodies. Maybe like a kid, you know, this close to being born is actually viable. And there's nuance there that people can, even when they don't agree, like respect that, like I can see like your point and mm-hmm. I can kind of overlap with you a little bit here. I feel like on the copper nickel mining, there's a broad majority of people could find some overlapping ground.
I think that's probably true. And I also think that the reason I say it's over, like too much attention paid is I think if you talk to people on the range and what problems there are in their lives and things that they wish were better about their community, nobody really says, I wish there were more copper nickel mining.
Right.
You know, it's not the most important thing to a lot of people, even on the range. And yet it is the thing that decides who gets elected to office. Local candidates run on it, like city council candidates run on it as though they would ever have any say in it. And it's just ridiculous.
But you asked the question earlier, you know, if my way of living was based around wild rice, mm-hmm. what's in it for me?
Right.
And I think, you know, I think the quick answer is, you know, there's nothing in it for you. There's only the chance of downside. There's not a lot mm-hmm. of upside. And I think coming up with an answer to that question that is not just downside risk is part of what we have to get to. I mean, we have to get to the point where...
Same with the jobs argument. You know, people who... I've actually written about that as like, if your argument is let's not mine here because of the environmental risk, I can respect that. But what do we tell the folks who live in the community? What are we going to do so that they have a chance at prosperity? And if they can't do the thing that they're you know, trained to do, or the culturally that they understand, which is mining, then what is the thing? What do we do?
Right.
And I think that's where you mentioned leadership. I think that is the issue, is you need leadership. Not everybody is going to sit here and think of, oh, well, we're going to code and we're going to write some new software and sell it and make billions of dollars. Every single guy and gal living on the range isn't thinking that way. You got to think of like, what are we really going to do so that people can provide for their families, which is really at the core of what a lot of people want.
Well, and how do we get that base economy so that we can have more doctors that want to live here, mm-hmm. more, you know, professionals that want to live here? Cause and then raise everybody else's quality of life. How can we have, you know, we've got a library, we've got movie theaters, we've got theater, we've got, okay. I think those are all great, but I look at that as being very fragile because they're kind of built on this, benevolence infrastructure, mm-hmm. as opposed to like, we're going to sustain this because we've got enough people, enough wealth, enough, you know, you look at some of the crazy things they built in the mining days, the wealthy people in those cities built in the mining days is because they had real wealth and they wanted to have real culture that went along with that wealth.
Yep. Opera houses and things like that.
Our culture here is based on this kind of fragile edifice of, you know, can we get this state grant? Can we get this outside funding? I would like to see us have like true wealth so that we can sustain these cultural things we want. Mm-hmm. This is where I would like to get us to, which is a very different vision than let's create jobs so we can have a multiplier effect. So like the third and fourth quarter GDP is, you know, 0.2% higher, so that, you know, macro economists and politicians can crow about it.
Right.
Because I don't care about those people. Like, I don't buy into their value system. Like, I think their value system is incorrect.
And I don't disagree with you.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Chuck, you got. I think you got
to
get your.
Meeting, I do have right? to go. Yep, yeah. I've got a meeting in 5 minutes.
Okay, so it's been Dig Deep. If you want to let us know if you agreed with those 4 points or you disagreed, please send us an email, comments at kaxc.org. Thanks, you guys.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.